The meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. It is Tuesday, January 31st, and I'd like to welcome all of you back to a new session. We're pleased to have you with us and hoping a few more members join us quickly. Today on our agenda, we are going to do an overview of the state budget that was enacted and also review the forecast that came out on December 1st. We are looking toward another forecast on February 29th, but I think that indications are that it may not be dramatically changed. We're hoping it doesn't change dramatically in that time. It's a short period between forecasts this time. So we were, of course, very pleased that we had a forecast of a budget surplus, and we're looking forward to the forecast in February as well. But presenting, and before I start, I want to introduce you to somebody. I have a new committee administrator. It's Jennifer Burquam, and she actually is Senator Magnus's committee administrator for agriculture, too. My former administrator, Amy Wallstein, went to work for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce as their education policy analyst, and so we had an opening and decided that we would be willing to share, and Senator Magnus was very generous to make that agreement with me so that Jennifer could help us for the balance of this session. And we're very happy to have her on board. She comes highly recommended for her efficiencies and skills, and so we're very pleased. Her room is in room 206, so if you do have want to talk to her, get on the agenda for the Finance Committee, that is where you will find her. So welcome, Jennifer. And today we have Brent Gustafson, our lead fiscal analyst, who is going to give us the overview. So, Brent, if you'd like to start.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, what I'm going to do, is, as the Chair mentioned, is just sort of refresh our memory as to what the enacted budget was for fiscal year 2012 and 13. We're nearing 7 months into that fiscal biennium, and just want to recap where the budget was and how we met the budget challenge last session, and recap the November forecast, as well as just looking ahead what the longer-term implications are of both of those. So it'd be more refresher than anything new, but we thought it would be good to revisit some of these issues and get back on talking about budget matters. So as no one needs a reminder to the fact that last year, the February forecast showed a $5 billion general fund shortfall between revenues and expenditures. And this slide, there's two things in your packet. One is a set of slides that I'm going to walk through, and then a what looks like a tracking sheet, but it's just the November forecast material that MMB provides. But I've rearrayed it to match the Senate committee structure because the MMB's material doesn't quite match our structure. So those are the two pieces of material I have. So you've got a set of the handouts because some of the numbers on the screen might be a little tricky. Hopefully the handout helps in that regard. But you'll see that the various big tools that were used as part of the budget solution, obviously the common tools of spending reduction was the biggest tool used. A continuation of the K-12 shift from the prior biennium made up a significant portion of the solution, as well as the expanded shift, the sale of tobacco securitization bonds, followed by the reserves, and a small increase in net revenues from some compliance activities and transfers from other funds. The next slide on the top of page 2 in your handout looks at the components of the budget solution relative to what the governor had proposed in his supplemental budget in March, as well as what the legislature had passed in May but was vetoed by the governor. That's what's labeled conference reports. And so the reason to look at this just a little bit is it has implications for the longer term as we look at the next biennium, and the fact that one-time solutions were a part of the budget solution, obviously, and they were all along. The governor's original budget had the use of some reserves and shifts that are one-time in nature. The conference reports did as well. And the difference was that at the end of the day, when the budget was enacted in July, the use of one-time resources was significantly larger than it had been in either of those two prior budgets. and that has implications for the future in terms of how much of the budget solution carries into the future, the fact that the state has confronted a structural imbalance, meaning what we bring in any given biennium and what we spend in any biennium has been mismatched for a couple of biennia and continues into the future, and that's due to the nature of one-time solutions being part of budget fixes. And so you see how that looked as we dealt with it in the spring compared to how it was enacted in the summer. Looking another level down in terms of the nature of those reductions, the K-12 school shifts and the tobacco securitization bonds are actually, while people sometimes talk about them as revenue or borrowing from the schools, or you hear that kind of phrasing, they're actually, from the standpoint of the state's budget, a reduction in spending. And so when you look at revenue and spending changes enacted in the biennial budget, you see that the vast majority shows up then as expenditure reductions, because that's where the shifts and the securitization bond, their effect on the general fund is lower spending from the general fund. And so that's how it looks a little different when you break it apart this way. And then just one more level down, this committee, having the respective finance chairs, knows this slide perhaps better than I, in that these are the respective omnibus bills that were enacted and the effect they had. And so you can see then we typically break out in K-12 the effect of the shift and the effect of other spending, because it can so distort the effect. And so you see that the underlying spending in K-12 due to an enacted formula increase is actually higher spending. But when you add the effect of the shifts, biennium to biennium is a reduction. And you see then the various spending reductions in the omnibus bills that you're all familiar with, the largest reductions in health and human services, followed by property tax aids and credits, and higher education. You see here the reduction in debt service. That's where the tobacco securitization revenue has an effect. It's not actually revenue to the general fund. It's revenue to a separate fund, but it reduces the need for the general fund to spend on debt service. So because it replaced that general fund spending, you see here that effect, that the general fund needed to spend $640 million less than had been budgeted, because a different revenue source was paying for debt service, and that was the tobacco securitization. So that's 640 of the 648 that's included there.
Mr. Gustafson, isn't it correct to say that the tobacco securitization funds could only be used actually to pay off debt and could not be used for operating costs, so that's why it's in this category, correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That there are legal and constitutional issues around what that money could be used for, and so because the payment of principal and interest on prior bond authorizations was deemed a one-time capital expenditure, that the tobacco securitization money could be used in that regard and still be legal and not considered borrowing for operating costs. So I want to talk a little bit about the longer-term implications of the
just a moment, Senator Olson.
I'm not sure my brain is in gear this morning, but the shift money, I presume the tobacco settlement money will. That'll just show up this way once, since the impact of that has essentially already been covered with the general formula in the coming year.
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, distinguish between the K-12 shift and the tobacco securitization. Yeah. Both are one-time. Were one-time tools to help balance the budget, mm-hmm. And once utilized, sort of done until they're, in this case of the school shift, repaid. And then, and as you know, the school shift has been utilized multiple times by the state as a budget balancing tool and then repaid. So once it's utilized, the effect is done. Now, the tobacco securitization bond has an effect on an ongoing basis that we don't see with the K-12 shift. The K-12 shift is a one-time adjustment in the timing of when we pay school districts. So that effect is realized in this biennium, and then on an ongoing basis, we're on a different payment schedule. The tobacco securitization bond was a one-time budget balancing tool to lower debt service costs in this biennium. The implication, however, is that a revenue source is needed to pay principal and interest on that bond, and the source of that revenue is what had previously been entirely a general fund revenue, which is the tobacco settlement proceeds from the 1998 lawsuit against a variety of tobacco companies. And so significant portion of that, I want to say it's close to half of that revenue on an ongoing basis for 20 years, will instead of come to the general fund, will go to pay principal and interest on the securitization bonds.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in terms of what it will look like on this forecast, let me just concentrate on the shift. That won't show as a negative in terms like a cut of spending then.
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson.
It's just showing that one time. Okay, thank you. It wasn't clear if you were saying that it wouldn't clear until gotcha. It was paid back, but that is that what you're saying is that's not the case.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, right?
Thank you.
So we've talked about one-time tools, and so I want to talk a little bit about what are often referred to as the tails or the next biennium impact of the enacted budget. And so still talking about how things looked last July at the time the budget was enacted. The 2012 and 13 budget, as we passed it, spent more than we were at the time estimating to bring in this biennium. And so we had a structural gap in the current biennium that was expected to continue, and at the time of enactment was expected to be $1.9 billion in the 2014 and 15 biennium. Additionally, we'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute, but the school shift expansion that was included added to a list of items that had already been enacted into law that are contingencies on forecast surpluses. And so the idea that when things got better, we would repay some of these one-time tools. But at the end of the session, there were substantial claims on future resources in addition to the structural gap. Now, the $1.9 billion structural imbalance that was projected at the end of session, while significant, was substantially larger than had been envisioned at the time of the February 2011 forecast. At the time of the forecast, we thought that gap would be $4.4 billion. Important caveat there was the assumption that the K-12, at the time, a year ago, the February forecast assumed a full school shift buyback. So that was a piece of why that number was so big. But while there were significant use of one-time tools in the enacted budget, there were permanent changes and a lower spending base, some ongoing revenues. And so the structural picture was better than had been projected in February. You see it here on a year-by-year basis. And then the slide on the bottom of page four is just looking at the three biennium period, the biennium we concluded 2010-11 that closed last June 30, the enacted budget. This is not the current forecast, but at the time of enactment, we thought we would spend $615 million more than we're going to bring in this biennium, and then the ongoing implications. And you see in the far right column the fact that at the time we enacted the budget, we were planning for revenues to grow nearly $1.6 billion, but for spending to grow $2.8 billion. And at the end, I'll have an updated slide of this for the November forecast. But this is what it looked like at the time we enacted the budget. So I mentioned the future contingencies, and we all saw this in the November forecast. We'll talk a little more about that. But current law directs where any future surpluses go in a prioritized order and with dollar-specific amounts in some case. But the claims on these future resources, while this section of law has been around a long time, the items included have grown over time, and certainly the amounts have grown. And so at the time the budget was enacted, we had estimated that we had $3.6 billion of claims on future resources, that until we had repaid and satisfied all of those contingencies, we would need to accumulate $3.6 billion of surpluses before we showed money on the bottom line without any claim on it. And so, again, while this provision has been there and been utilized or applied during various forecast surpluses, the number of items included has gotten bigger, and certainly the dollar amounts are much bigger than they've ever been in the past.
Excuse me, question?
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With regard to the K-12 property tax recognition shift, I wasn't thinking that that was also in law that we must pay that back. I thought that was the prerogative of the legislature. That's not.
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, certainly the adjustments to the timing of property tax recognition is within the purview of the legislature and has been adjusted at various times in the past. This is referring to what where the law directs future surpluses to go. And so if future surpluses satisfy the first three of those commitments and additional resources were available, even without additional legislative action, that property tax recognition shift percentage would come down without any further action by the legislature.
Thank you.
So continuing on then, everything to this point has been, how did things look last July at the time we enacted the budget? November forecast, as Commissioner Showalter noted, was a surprise to all, that a projected surplus of $876 million for the biennium, the 12 and 13 biennium. However, the MMB also thought it was important to point out that much of that surplus resulted from things from the prior biennium that had already closed. Revenues in the prior biennium closed when they wrapped up the books, $358 million higher than had been forecast last February, and spending closed $200 million lower, $205 million lower, much of it the effect of federal Medicaid policies as it related to enhanced matching rate on Medicaid, part of the federal stimulus bill, and part of it being due to refunds that had not been anticipated at the time last February's forecast. So revenue was higher, spending was lower. We closed the prior biennium in better shape than we expected. That money comes forward to this biennium. So that was what was better in the forecast. What was worse were the economic assumptions that were projected in November. And the expectation of lower economic growth during this two-year period than the assumptions that we used to build the budget. And actually, the actual revenue coming in 12 and 13 was expected to be $24 million lower than at the time the budget was enacted.
Mr. Gustafson, didn't that assumption just go up somewhat? I thought I just read that somewhere. I can't remember the figure, but it has been increasing since this forecast was put out.
Madam Chair, members, every month Global Insight, who is the state's macroeconomic consultant, provides a new forecast to MMB. MMB does not fully model state tax revenues and expenditures to produce a new forecast every month, but we get updated economic data. And that's part of what most forecasting firms do, is on a monthly basis produce their latest expectation for the economy. And you may recall the January economic update that MMB provided us had Global Insights data and expectation updated for that period of time. And at that time, they had raised their expected growth rate. And I actually have a slide on this, but why don't I just jump ahead to it quickly. So the economic growth that was expected, and you see on this chart, the February 2011 economic growth numbers were, you see that, the 3.2, 2.9, 3.1%. The reason this is an important factor is, as you know, many of the revenues, particularly the state's general fund, are economically sensitive. Income tax, sales tax are economically sensitive, and so inflation-adjusted gross domestic product is an important variable as the state's economists model tax revenue. So this is why this is an important indicator and why it's tracked on a monthly basis or looked at so closely. And so you see the February 11 numbers were what was underlying the revenue assumptions we used to enact the budget. And you see how sharply lower they were by the time we got to the November forecast. The MMB forecast document attributes much of the change to lower consumer confidence, problems with European debt, implications from Asian supply chains disrupted by the earthquake and tsunami. So there are multiple factors affecting the macroeconomy that we're expecting to result in lower economic growth. So those are the 1.6 and 2.5, Madam Chair, to your question. In the January update, Global Insight was now assuming 2% in 2012 and 2.4% in 13. So slightly higher in 12, slightly lower in 13, but overall would result in a higher rate of growth for the biennium than November forecast. It's important to note that the January update is not a full forecast, and so many things happen month to month, and the February data that will become part of our February 2012 forecast, MMB will get in about a week or a week's time or so, and they'll start modeling then the revenue and spending implications of that new forecast. But to your point, Madam Chair, since the time of November forecast, economic indicators appear to be slightly better.
Mr. Gustafson, I'm a little confused. With that high projection in the February 2011 forecast, but then it supposedly dropped, how did we end up with $358 million in higher revenues for the last biennium?
Madam Chair, I think there are a number of factors at play, but I think what you see here is calendar year 2011 and the change in calendar year 11 growth. You'll recall that in the November forecast, Dr. Stinson talked a lot about the fact that much of the revenue that they saw as improvement actually came from tax year 2010 final payments. And so the results were that fairly old tax implications were resulting in higher revenue. Additionally, these are national gross domestic product figures. There was write up in the November forecast as well as the January update that the Minnesota economy is doing slightly better than the national economy. So those things are factors that contribute. There are multiple reasons of why revenue was higher, but one of the drivers was tax year 2010 final payments. And ordinarily, if we saw improvement in historical years or closed tax years that way, we would have assumed a higher base, and growing off a bigger base than previously assumed would result in higher revenues. However, these figures, the lower growth off that higher base, really wiped out the effect of that higher base. So normally, growing off the bigger base would have resulted in a higher revenue estimate, but this really completely mitigated that effect.
Thank you.
Going back a slide to the top of your page 6 in your handout, slide number 11, where did the surplus come from in a little more detail? Talked about the tax revenue being higher, and much of this forecast was really a result of Health and Human Services lower expenditures. $149 million of it came from lower expenditures last fiscal year, and then the ongoing implications of $308 million lower in this bank. So you see much of the forecast story being a prior biennium story, and then also being a Health and Human Services story, but that story being really driven by higher participation by the federal government in the state medical assistance program, resulting in lower state outlays, and that's where the savings come from.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you. Mr. Gustafson, I thought I also remembered some comments during when we got the last forecast that not as many people chose to use the government programs as we had expected. And I wondered if that might change in terms of, you know, changing from one program to another. Sometimes there's barriers to entry. Sometimes people aren't following it. They don't fill out the paperwork. How much of the surplus is due to that versus the government, federal government, contributing more to our total spend?
Mr. Gustafson?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I don't know that I could answer that question. You are right that at the time of the November forecast, part of the reason for those expenditure savings was a lower and slower rate of enrollment growth than had been previously expected. You're right to note that those programs are fairly dynamic, that people may be eligible for one program or not another. And it's part of the challenge in forecasting or estimating changes in law pertaining to program eligibility. I think I'd have to defer to the Department of Human Services staff to disentangle those effects.
Okay, thank you.
So we already talked about the slide on the bottom of page 6. I would just note that the macroeconomic assumptions in November and what are likely to continue to be the assumptions in February assumed a continuation of the federal payroll tax cut and extended unemployment insurance. Those were, at the time of the November forecast, considered risks to the forecast. If at the time of the November forecast those were set to expire December 31st, 2011, it was uncertainty at the time of the November forecast whether that would happen. As you all know, Congress and the President agreed to a two-month extension. Many indications are they will revisit that issue, and but I believe Global Insight, I don't know this for certain, but I believe Global Insight will likely stick with that assumption and the continuation. However, it was noted in November as a risk because it's not an economic-driven factor. It's a policy decision.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. So can we expect in the February forecast that will you they've only done a two-month extension, which is January and February. So are you going to assume, as Midwest, or what is the company again, that it will continue or not? Because otherwise we're going to see a quite a drastic change.
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, you may recall Dr. Stinson noted that if no extension had been enacted, the guess at that time was that about half of the growth assumed in the forecast would disappear. That roughly, I think he suggested somewhere between a half and a full point, and so roughly half of that growth in the assumed GDP numbers would have gone away without that extension. Global Insight made the assumption that it would continue, that policymakers would act to extend those. They have to make a number of guesses about federal monetary and fiscal policy. I'm just making my own guess that they will continue to use that assumption because of how they described it in November. They may change that assumption, but it will likely be noted in February as a continued risk because there's uncertainty, and at the time the February forecast is produced, we're not likely to have resolution at a federal level of that issue. However, Global Insight will take a guess and be clear about their assumption, whether they're assuming it to continue or whether they're assuming after 2 months it goes away, and that will have implications for their growth numbers.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Gustafson, didn't they say about $400 million? So if they took away that, you know, our surplus could have been about $476 million or around $500 million instead. But it does point out that reducing tax rates does stimulate economic activity and actually generates a lot more revenue for us. And so from that perspective, it's been helpful.
Madam Chair, members, just moving on to slide 13, top of page 7. More specifically, this is we talked about those statutory allocations or the claims on future resources. And you'll recall that the $876 million surplus became a zero on the bottom line because of existing state law that directed where that money went. And so the entire forecast balance needed to be allocated within 2 weeks of the forecast by law, and $255 million of it went to restore the cash flow account. At the time the budget was enacted, the budget solution, as I noted earlier, utilized a portion of the cash flow account, and there was $95 million remaining at the time the budget was enacted. The statute in 16A-152 says it should be $350 million, so the first $255 million went there. Secondly, the budget reserve has the next claim on surplus resources, and by law, it needs to we need to allocate resources until it gets to $653 million. The next $621 million went there, which left us at $648 million in the budget reserve as of the time of the November forecast.
Wow, just $5 million more, and we would have filled up our reserve, too.
That's right, Madam Chair. Members, the next slide is one I showed earlier, which was the structural implications of the enacted budget at the time it was enacted. This is what it looks like updated for the November forecast, where we have a closed 2010 and 11 biennium, the updated November forecast numbers for revenue and spending. You recall that at the time the budget was enacted, this was a $615 million structural imbalance in 12 and 13 and a $1.9 billion structural imbalance in the out years. Both those numbers have improved, not surprisingly, with lower spending and slightly, the revenue numbers were lower in November and 12 and 13, but the lower spending resulted in the reduction in that structural imbalance. So you see that the $1.9 billion in 14 and 15 is now $1.3 billion, and you see that the expected growth in revenue from 12 and 13 to 14 and 15 is a $2 billion growth in revenue. However, the current assumptions are that spending will grow $3 billion in the next biennium. And so that's that mismatch that has occurred for a number of years. But you see really then that the fact that the prior biennium, 10 and 11, turned out better were the resources that helped make the surplus possible. So in the last biennium that we closed, we brought in more money than we spent. That's not the current assumption for this biennium or the next.
Mr. Gustafson, when they project future growth in the budget or expenditures, are they basing it mostly on programs like the education program where we know we're going to have more pupils? How do they estimate what we're going to do in increased spending? Do they just do it on historical past? Some of it, you know, traditionally the legislature has increased spending this much. How do they do it?
Madam Chair, great question. And members have probably heard the term current law, that the forecast is a current law forecast. Other places do what's maybe referred to as a current services forecast. What would it take to keep things going the way they are now? But by law, the forecast is structured to only reflect current laws. And so what it is saying is that what's our best estimate of revenues and expenditures based on our current tax laws and our current statutory obligations. And what that means, as you note, for things like K-12 education is when our demographic data suggests a slight growth in student enrollment and we pay school aides on a per-student basis, on a year-on-year basis, that's going to grow. Additionally, many health and human services programs, particularly healthcare programs, have growth in enrollment on a year-on-year basis. And so because the statute creates the obligation to provide the service and because in school aids the statute provides the obligation to make the payment, that's what the current law says will happen, and that's what's assumed. Similarly with tax revenues, we assume that today's tax laws, what our rates are, what our brackets are, the current structure, the current rate on sales tax, that will continue on into the future. Makes no assumption that we're going to make a change. It assumes that what we have today is what we'll have next year, the year after that. And that's how it's projected. The other, I will note, however, that in the neighborhood of 80% of the state's general fund spending are in programs that are referred to as forecast programs or some sense of entitlement, and that would be school aids, health and human services entitlements. Debt service is a significant one as well, the obligation to make payments on prior authorized general obligation bonds, property tax credits, tax credits to individuals. Those things are all re-estimated every forecast based on current law, but when you tally that all together, it's approaching 80% of the state's general fund.
Now, Mr. Gustafson, they also put in their projections, though, that we would pass a $750 million bonding bill, so that they put those out-year costs into it as well. So our actions, even if we didn't change current law for the entitlement programs, some of our actions could still affect that spending expenditure side of things. Say we did a $450 or $500 million bonding bill, then obviously that would lower the out-year costs. What about like higher education? Do they do any estimate of growth in that, or because that's not a forecasted program, it's just where it is now, or do they consider something?
Madam Chair, I'll address both points you raised. On higher education, I should have noted previously that for things that are not forecast, what we assume on an ongoing basis, sort of that 14-15 effect will be the law defines the base as the last appropriated amount. So whatever we appropriated in 2013 is assumed to be the base in 14 and in 15. And so in our allocations to the University of Minnesota and Minsky, that's simply an appropriated amount. If I'm not mistaken, I believe there is some forecast element to the state grant program, but that's a relatively small subset of the higher ed appropriations. So there's no assumption that we either increase or decrease aid to the higher ed systems as part of the ongoing budget assumptions. You are right to note the implications of capital investment decisions and what that means for future debt service. Many years ago, on trying to estimate debt service costs or how big would the bonding bill be was difficult. And so the methodology there is a little bit of a mix where there is an assumption looking at history where it's a 10-year rolling average. So we look back 10 years and look at what size of bonding bill was enacted in an even-numbered year, what size of bonding bill was enacted in an odd-number year. If that was subsequently enacted in the future in a similar amount to meet that average, what would the debt service implications of that be? So it is making a guess about legislative action based on history as opposed to under a pure current law, you might say there's no future commitment to do additional projects. Therefore, it could be zero. If that were the case, every time the legislature enacted a bonding bill, it would need to identify significant resources for debt service. So that's the methodology. You're right, Madam Chair. The forecast assumes $775 million of new general obligation bond authorizations this session. If the enacted capital investment bill spends more or less than that, it would have implications for budgeted debt service.
Senator Langsa?
Well, Madam Chair, when it comes to a lot of things in the bonding bill, like the higher education, for example, there's a lot of money that goes into what we call HEAP or asset preservation, and then most of the MNSCU is totally rehabilitating older buildings. That has the effect of lowering energy costs to quite a bit. So, sure, if you just look at the debt service, that would be up if you're over and above the difference between 500 or 775. But there are other benefits there that would lower costs. So I think that's all got to be taken into consideration. And even a situation like the Rochester Event Center would bring in thousands of people into Minnesota that don't come here now, and that would have an effect. So I think all of that's got to be taken into account rather than just isolating the debt service.
Thank you. Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair, Mr. Gustafson, when you talk about the forecasted growth, particularly with health and human services and entitlement programs. As I understand it, much of that growth has to do with our aging population, the seniors, versus what people generally would think of as, quote, more welfare programs. So when we do those forecasted projections, are we actually taking our demographic changes with regard to aging? Is that how we do it? Is that what's factored in as well?
Mr. Gustafson?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I will again defer to the Department of Human Services on the specifics. However, the short answer is yes. There are many data factors in that forecast looking at demographic trends, looking at healthcare trends, looking at utilization trends. It is a forecast heavily dependent on trend data and looking at what are happening with those underlying populations. And in terms of growth, I think it's important to distinguish, and I believe that the Department of Human Services can provide information about this. It's important to distinguish growth in dollars and growth in people, because the majority of program enrollees are what are typically low-income families with children in terms of health care program enrollees. However, the more expensive portions of program enrollees tend to be frail, elderly, and disabled individuals. Those are a higher cost per person, but they're a lower portion of the enrollee population.
Gotcha.
And so both are important to understand, and DHS has a lot of data and looks at that data as they try to project future costs. So when you think about growth, I think it's important to disentangle cost growth and population growth, because they can be very different.
Thank you.
Continue, please.
Madam Chair, just the next two slides in your packet, both on page 8, are really just the where it comes from, where it goes comparison. And the top of that page is the general fund, and the bottom of the page would be all operating funds. In the general fund, as I noted earlier, the income and sales tax are really the workhorse of the general fund revenues, with both of them, however, having economic sensitivity, which has been part of what you all have experienced and grappled with in enacting the budget. And then you see the mix of other resources. The general fund expenditures, as you all know, the greatest slice of the pie is in K-12 education, followed by health and human services, and you see the other mix there. And the reason I like to have these on the same page is you can see the contrast then on the bottom of your page 8. When you look at all funds, it's important to remember that beyond the general fund and the nearly $34 billion spent in the general fund this biennium, we're going to spend $62 billion in total. And you see then that the general fund is the state's largest and most flexible fund, which is why it is of primary focus during legislative budget discussions. But it's only really half the story. Federal funding makes up about 29% of the enacted or the operating budget in, based on the November forecast. The biggest portion of that is the federal match on Medicaid expenditures, medical assistance. And so those are the real drivers. And that's why when you look on the right-hand side of that, the right-hand side of that slide, why while Health and Human Services is the second largest slice of the pie, and the general fund becomes easily the largest when looking at an all funds consideration, because the federal government matches almost every dollar we spend in medical assistance with an additional dollar of federal Medicaid spending.
Wow.
Madam Chair, the top of page 9 is a slide that there's a lot of focus in the last session on biennial growth. And we talked early on about the one-time factors in the enacted budget, and that's true in the 2010 and 11 budget as well as 12 and 13. And those one-time tools can have a significant distorting effect when looking at biennial change. And so while there's an awful lot of figures on this slide, I'll try to focus on the basics. The blue portion are what actual general fund expenditures are, with no distorting effect, or not trying to account for the distortions whatsoever. Just straight up general fund spending was just a hair under $30 billion in 10 and 11, just under $34 billion this biennium, going to $37 billion the next. That's with no adjustments whatsoever. And you see the respective growth rates there. Without trying to account for any of those factors, the budget based on the November forecast, going to be 13.5% larger than last biennium, and we'll go another nearly 9% into the next biennium. However, the reason to try to adjust this is because there are underlying state commitments and obligations that we really just substituted the financing for. We substituted $2 billion of federal stimulus funding in the 10 and 11 biennium for things that would have otherwise been state general fund expenditures. We also utilized a sizable portion of K-12 shift resources in the prior biennium. And then in this enacted budget, we talked earlier on about the expanded shift as well as the tobacco securitization. And when trying to adjust for those factors and how much state-supported spending from things that have traditionally been general fund, that growth rate looks significantly different. It'd be 4.1%, and then accounting for the fact that we really have $35.5 billion of state-supported spending this biennium between the K-12 entitlements and the temporary substitution for debt service would be on the order of 35.5, and growing then into 37 in the following biennium would be 4.3%. So there's not necessarily a right way to look at these. There are multiple ways to look at it, which is why I try to provide all those calculations and the factors that contribute it, and how you look at it, I think, depends on how you see the importance of those factors.
Mr. Gustafson.
I think this is the best explanation I've ever seen. It really does explain it, because it's very easy to come from any direction you want to and make it sound like the spending is going up a lot more or less or whatever, just based upon what you're using. But this really does explain actual expenditures, and I think this is the first time I've seen it laid out quite this way, and it really does explain it quite well.
Mr. Gustafson, do you remember last year the forecast for the 12-13 biennium? Was it $39 billion? I'm thinking it was that high. And so that trajectory has really been slowed down, because even the 14-15 biennium is at 37 now. So do you recall?
Madam Chair, at the time of the February 2011 forecast, the 12 and 13 biennium was expected to be just over $39 billion, and the forecast for 2014 and 15 was 39.7. So those were the numbers on a current law basis a year ago.
Okay, thank you.
Prior to any legislative action on the budget. Madam Chair, just want to move beyond some of the general fund stuff briefly. Just a few other things to note. There was some uncertainty because of its newness at the time of the enacted budget of what the tobacco securitization bond would result in. You may recall that the language in the tax bill allowed the Commissioner of Management Budget to sell either a tobacco securitization bond or an appropriation bond. For legal reasons, the latter requires a legal or court validation process, and so we knew all along that MMB's first tranche would at least be a tobacco securitization bond. They ended up selling the full amount budgeted to realize the $640 million reduction that was part of the enacted budget. All told, it was $757 million in bonds, and we knew at the time it was enacted that it would be significantly above the 640 because they capitalized the principal and interest costs in 12 and 13 that had been part of the structure all along. When the actual sale occurred, it was 757 with the 4.75% interest rate. So that information you've probably seen before, but just that was a big unknown at the time of the enacted budget. What would the market do with that? And it came out, I think, better than I know it was better than we had assumed at the time of the enacted budget and what it meant for the ongoing revenue implications. And I think it was just wanted to update the committee on where that resulted.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. Mr. Gustafson, so what does that amount to in millions after the interest rate? How long are these bonds sold for, 20 years or 30 years?
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, they are 20-year bonds, and I do not have with me that information. I could get back to you on the total cost over time period.
And Madam Chair,
Senator,
a couple more questions about this. How much was projected for us to get out of the tobacco funds before this action was taken?
Mr. Gustafson.
Amount.
It's correct that we did not use all of the money, right? There's maybe half of it was used to pay off the bonds, and there's still additional revenue coming straight into the general fund budget.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, the revenue from the tobacco settlements was $334 million in the last biennium, roughly $320 million this biennium, and in total will be about $325 million in the next biennium. However, roughly half of it, we will still have $178 million of general fund revenue from the tobacco settlement next biennium, and that difference, $150 million, will be used to pay the debt service, principal and interest payments on these bonds.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Christensen.
We talked earlier about the January economic update and what the outlook was for real GDP growth. The other important thing from that economic update was the fact that actual revenues have come in $62 million higher. Again, that's not a forecast. That's not money that we can count on until a full forecast is done. However, like many things, having a positive variance is better than a negative variance, and that was a piece of good news. Again, it's not a full forecast. I'm going to be cautious about reading too much into that, but seeing a positive variance, and as the chair noted, the fact that Global Insight is assuming higher growth, both of those are indicators, and MMB's write-up supports the fact that the economic recovery, while modest, seems to be on track, and that the economic outlook should hold. That said, still many, a number of risks, particularly around a European recession and federal fiscal policy. And finally, we talked about this as well, that if the forecast improves in February, the first $5 million would fully restore the budget reserve to its statutory maximum, and any amount beyond that $5 million would begin to be utilized to buy back or repay the school aid payment delay. The shift that was expanded in the enacted budget would start to be reduced if the forecast is positive. Madam Chair, we want to just point out a couple of non-general fund items. We've talked an awful lot about the general fund and some things that are just want to point out to the committee. Some members know this because of their committee assignments or chairmanships, but just a couple items of note. The Outdoor Heritage Fund, you recall the bill that appropriated money from the Legacy Constitutional Amendment. Typically, most budget bills enact both years of the biennium. The outdoor heritage portion of legacy funds only contained enacted appropriations for fiscal year 2012. And I know, or I believe, Senator Ingebrigtsen can correct me, I believe the LaSard Outdoor Heritage Council has made recommendations or has met recently. So there may be legislation on that. We, I think, touched on this last year. But the Game and Fish Fund, which is primarily the main operating account within the Game and Fish Fund where hunting and fishing licenses revenue is deposited, while has a small budgetary balance this biennium, is structurally imbalanced. And it has been for a few years, and that balance has been drawn down through the loss of some federal funding. Relatively stable revenue and expenditures, however, they're out of balance. And at some point, budgetary changes will need to be made, either in revenue or spending, to bring that fund into balance. But there's a small balance this biennium.
Mr. Gustafson, the Game and Fish Fund is funded solely through licenses and fees, or is that maybe Senator Ingebrigtsen can answer that too?
Madam Chair, I'll just comment. It's not solely from that source. However, that's the primary source. additional.
Oh, Mr. Mueller's here.
Mr. Mueller's here. That would be helpful.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Gustafson, with regard to the Health Care Access Fund, the significant structural surplus entails, I guess I'm surprised to see this given the legislation that was enacted last session that discontinued the provider tax.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, if memory serves, the reduction in the provider tax was contingent upon future determination of what that structure would look like. And so at the time of the November forecast, MMB did not assume that in 2014-15 that the provider tax would go away. And I may be incorrect in recalling, but I believe it was a phase down as opposed to an elimination. And so there is a surplus in the out years. And your point is well taken. I perhaps shouldn't have referred to it as a structural surplus, because if you look even further beyond 14-15, there are implications and it may be different. There is a projected budgetary balance in 2015 as a result of higher revenue in the out years compared to spending. But the full balance of the access fund in 2013 is transferred to the general fund. And so those items have been of budgetary concern in the past, which is why I noted it here.
Well, Madam
Senator Bonner.
And perhaps Senator Hand could say a few more words about that. But I thought that our legislation did directly have a process for ending that rather than having it be qualified on some outside effect.
And
Senator Hand?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I think Mr. Gustafson essentially described it correctly. We had the bill we passed triggers reductions in that tax contingent upon the status of the account. And so if there's a surplus that is generated, then that will trigger a reduction in the tax going forward. And so I think what he's saying is that the forecast is showing a surplus that will trigger a reduction in the rate going forward, and that will be evaluated. And there is, I can't recall the time frame, but over some period of time that is presumed in the law to end. But it doesn't have a end today structure. It is triggered based on the amount of money that's in the account. There was a concern that, of course, we keep that account solvent while we went through a reduction in the tax.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I can look at it, revisit that issue, and get back to you with what those triggers are and what the implications would be.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Dan Mueller from our office is our expert on the Game and Fish Fund, and I believe has distributed something I don't have in my slides, but I have a bit of a picture of, which shows the variety of revenue sources to the Game and Fish Fund. And so I'll just let him speak to that.
Mr. Mueller.
Madam Chair, I'm Dan Mueller. I'm a fiscal analyst for the Environment Committee. What I've handed out here is a history of just the operations account within the Game and Fish Fund. Again, there are a bunch of different accounts also attributed in the Game and Fish Fund for each of the different stamps, you know, like the pheasant stamp, duck stamps. But the main account is the Game and Fish Operations account, where all the hunting and fishing license go into, and it's the main expenditure account in the Game and Fish Fund. So what this slide shows, and it shows up much better in Brent's slide up there with the colors, but the bar part of it is the revenue, and then the line on top are the expenses. So you see over time, it's been fairly in sync, and but you'll see the last 4 years, almost 5 years, starting in fiscal year 11, where the revenues are not keeping up with the expenditures. Right now, there is an imbalance of about, you know, $7 to $8 million of expenditures over revenues coming into that account. One of the big parts of it is a drop-off in federal funds. Right now, we're projecting in fiscal year 12 and beyond about $23 million per year coming in federal dollars. It had been as high as $26 or $27 million per year, so that's about $4 million of it. The rest of it is sort of leveling off or even reduction of some hunting and fishing license revenues from what they were at their peak. There has been some drop-off in sales in that.
Mr. Mueller, we're showing a shortfall already for 2011 and a fairly significant one for this year. Do they have any reserve funds, or what is being done to address that?
Madam Chair, yes, they are spending down a reserve. There had been, in the game and fish operations account, the reserve or the balance had been as high as $18 to $19 million going back to fiscal year 9, but that amount is being spent down every year and are projecting starting at the end of fiscal year 14 that the deficit in that account will be about $6 million of going into the beginning of the next biennium.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions? Senator Engelbertson?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess the bottom line will be we will be coming forward with a new proposal to increase fees. We talked about it last year. I know the DNR came out with a proposal last year. But those fees are definitely needed. We have a citizen oversight committee that has met, and I think maybe everybody has seen that report. Those fees have not been addressed in the last 10, maybe even 11 years. So, we have to move cautiously as well. We don't want to lose hunting and fishing opportunities in Minnesota either. So. That along with, the most recent gray wolf situation, and looking at some new revenues there. Of course, there's going to be some cost with that as well. But so be looking for that on the horizon. And I understand, maybe Mr. Mueller can clarify this, that if we do run in the red, we can actually borrow from the general fund. Is that correct? Or take money from the general fund so long as it's paid back? I was the understanding of that, or
Senator Ingerson, the chair doesn't think that's a very good idea.
Oh, maybe I'm directing the question in the wrong place. But I understand that that has gone on in the past, just simply to get through the year. I've heard that information some time ago. I don't know if that's
Mr. Mueller. Has that been done,
Madam Chair and Senator Ingerson? We haven't not in while I've been doing this because there always has been a fund balance in the game and fish fund. I mean, conceivably, you could do it temporarily. It would probably take some legislation to do it, knowing that if you have revenues coming in from a hunting and fishing license increase that could pay it back or some of that. I guess conceivably, yes, it could be done. Or you could also shift expenditures maybe that are set to come out of the game and fish account and move those expenditures over to the general fund and then backload them onto the game and fish account later or something like that. So there's different ways you can do things to keep this account whole by moving expenditures to other funds temporarily and then backloading them back to this account. But it, as you said, it needs to be addressed.
Senator Ingerson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe you could address the federal dollars that you talk about, the revenue that comes in. Maybe the committee's not real clear on just how those dollars are generated through purchasing of hunting and fishing. And
Mr. Mueller?
Madam Chair and Senator Ingerson, and I'll briefly go over it. There is someone here from the DNR, too, that could help if I don't explain it well enough. But we do get – there's two pots of money from the federal government that go right into the Game and Fish Fund and are not counted in some of Brent's other numbers that count federal dollars. There's some federal dollars that go right into our Game and Fish Fund. Pittman Roberts and the Dingle Johnson, and those are generated from a federal surtax on various guns and ammunition, and then also from other sporting goods, and then are spread out to the state. So, and like I said, those dollars have been variable through the years and are now coming down from their peak level.
Madam Chair.
That's Senator Stump, and welcome to our committee. Senator Stump is a new addition. He's replacing Senator Berglund on the Finance Committee, and I'm very happy to have you here.
Thank you. Senator Ingerson, maybe you could increase the sale of muzzleloader licenses if you allowed scopes on muzzleloaders. would drive, drive huge, huge increases in licenses.
Looks Madam, like it might Madam be Chair. Popular. Senator Langseth.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess most of the sportsmen's groups in the state have urged an increase, so I think the people that will be paying for it are saying raise it. So I think this one should be a little, it's probably a little bit different than anything else we'd be considering on raising.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Langseth and Stump, for those comments. You're right. Last year, I think our emails were filled with those people saying, We're willing to take an increase in fees. We haven't for a long time. You will be hearing that coming forward. The DNR's got their proposal together. And yes, Senator Stumpf, I think by putting scopes on muzzle loaders, we'll see a huge increase in revenue. And I'm glad you're supporting that. And I think Senator Higgins would support that as well. So.
Oh, I'm sure I will, yeah.
Of course, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
There's so many muzzle loaders in my district.
But a lot of them actually leave, though, to come out, and we all know that, too. So.
Well, we have to make sure we have enough deer population. But with the mild winter, I would hope that the population would be doing much better because they really took a hit last year.
Madam Chair, they're saying it's going to be very, very good for the deer population this weather. So, yep.
Right. They don't even have to dig for their food right now. There's no snow cover for them, so easy pickings for them.
The deer and the wild turkey.
Madam Chair, the last point I wanted to touch on is just on the, we talked a little bit about it earlier, but on capital investment. And as you all know, traditionally, the even number legislative session has had a focus on the capital budget, often referred to as the bonding bill. The sale of general obligation bonds backed by general fund tax revenues is a primary means of financing capital and construction, but it's not the only means. User fees of bonds from other funds, occasionally general fund cash, are means of financing capital projects, so it's not solely bonding. I just want to make that distinction. And then members are aware that there are limitations both on the amount of borrowing the state can do under debt guidelines, as well as there are limitations on the use of bond proceeds, what you can buy, what you can build with bond proceeds. And so those limitations are often part of the discussion on how much and what for is part of capital investment. And as we noted earlier, the forecast assumes, based on 10-year rolling average, that the enacted and enacted capital investment bill this year would authorize $775 million of new GO bonds. That may or may not happen, but that's what's assumed in the forecast. Any amount higher than that would require budgeting additional general fund resources for the debt service. An amount lower than that would result in general fund savings. But I will point out that both of those amounts are largely a tails issue. The amounts in 2013 would be relatively modest, but the impacts in the tails can be more significant. Madam Chair, that's the last slide I have, but any further questions, be happy to deal with on this slide or others.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langseth.
I'd just like to mention, I think once a year we get this little booklet from the Tax Foundation, which is a federal group and a conservative group. They've got Minnesota 43rd in the United States in per capita debt. So I've heard people say we're hopelessly in debt. Well, they kind of get these deficits mixed up with the general fund debt and so on, but we are actually very low as compared to other states when it comes to the GO debt.
I think it's been helpful that we've had a guideline all along that has, you know, kept us at a reasonable level. So we are, I've seen those same statistics, and we are one of the lower percent of our revenue goes to paying off bonds. So that is true. I do have somebody here who could help answer Senator Bonhoff's question. It's Tim Walsh, and he's from Scott County Human Services, and he was sitting here listening and actually has an explanation for some of the reduction in use of the services and programs that we have, perhaps. I think that's what he's wanting to explain.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Walsh. I'm the Director of Health and Human Services for Scott County. I'm also part of the Minnesota Association for County Social Service Administrators. And a lot of what you see, of course, at the state level is driven by local expenditures. We're reimbursed by the state and by the federal government for our expenditures. We are the Health and Human Services Delivery System. So the first answer I'd have to the senator's question is actually we don't deserve a lot of credit for what you're seeing in the macro trends in expenditures, and that's going to surprise some people. What's happening to sociodemographics in our country is most problem indicators in our society actually have been going down for about 40 years, believe it or not. Comparing the last 20 years to the first 20 years, the last 40 years, problem indicators have been going down. And so what that means is better communities over time, better families over time, generally speaking, better kids, and probably better parenting, too. So those are the macro trends, and there's numerous books out about that right now. And so when we see things like out-of-home placements going down, which has gone down dramatically in almost every county, if not every county, we take some of the credit for that, but actually most of the credit is due to the fact that there's less kids that need to go into out-of-home placement. The credit that we do take is that we have programs and services that decrease the need for out-of-home placement, if that makes sense. So that's a huge thing right there. And then if you recall, if you see this in the news lately, the utilization of health care has gone down pretty dramatically, and it's in fact the increase in health care costs have been one of the lowest on record, if not the lowest, if I recall. But the healthcare utilization has gone down, way down, and we deserve some of the credit for that with counties working with the state. Most of our programs are community-based, which means that we work with people in the community to take care of themselves with their families, and because of that, their healthcare utilization goes way down. It's actually working. You have also enacted managed care. Managed care approaches have gone down, had our costs go way down because managed care is working. Managed care as a partnership between the state and the counties is actually working to bring costs way down. So that's big. And then also you have enacted human services redesign legislation. And so what also is going on at the local level is consolidation of health and human services with community health. We're actually bringing our overall infrastructure costs down, and we're bringing down the cost of administration. I think you'll notice that in our total costs. And then also, you were a very strong proponent several years ago with us, with the federal government, to maintain Medicaid reimbursement rates, if you recall. I don't know. It was actually a moratorium first on Medicaid rates, and then we, all of us in Minnesota, actually led a kind of a nationwide movement to not change the Medicaid rates. We're seeing that revenue coming in. We preserved about $50 billion on the national level through the efforts of Minnesota. We took the lead on this, and we preserved $50 billion per year in Medicaid reimbursement rates per year, and that translated into $100 million of saved revenue from the federal government coming back to Minnesota. You were a strong proponent of that. The legislature was, along with county and county associations and our partners. So that's been huge. You've also been a proponent of technology and automation, and I'm here to tell you that that's working. Technology and automation has been going very well. We've automated our economic assistance programs in most of the larger counties, and even the smaller counties and regions are starting to partner together now to use technology to automate. We have therefore been able to take on much larger caseloads. In Scott County, we've absorbed a 25% increase in our caseloads because we're using technology and we're using automation. And we'll come back to you with other ideas for technology and automation this next year in our partnerships with the Office of Enterprise Technology and the Department of Human Services. We're working very well with them to automate. And along with that, we've been simplifying our processes, and we've been working with the Department of Human Services to simplify our processes. I think you've probably heard testimony that in Minnesota, we have 16,000 rules that we have to deal with within our public assistance programs. And so right now we're working, based on your legislation, we're working with the Department of Human Services to align policy, to streamline programs, and to simplify our processes. We're going to simplify public assistance programs in Minnesota based on your leadership within the omnibus bill last year, and also use the technology to further improve what we're doing. As a result of our efforts, but mostly due to sociodemographic trends, we are also seeing a decrease in correctional placements, juvenile correctional and adult correctional. I think if you check in with your county colleagues, commissioners, you're seeing a decrease in jail populations across the state. That's mostly sociodemographic. We'd like to take credit for it, but that's simply not true. Crime in most categories is at, not I won't say an all-time low, but a low of about 45 years. And that is a sociodemographic change. But we are using approaches like signs of safety. That's an early intervention and non-traditional form of child protection. We intervene with high-risk families and children early on, and because we intervene with them early on and we deal with them in a non-traditional way, they don't show up in deep-end costs. And that has been an extremely effective, and again, based on the leadership of the legislature and in the administration and counties working in partnership with state agencies. So that has also been huge. So in terms of trends in our costs with the Great Recession, we did see, as you would expect, dramatic increases in use of employment and training services. But I'd ask you to take a look at what's called the foot traffic of workforce centers. We are actually starting to see a fairly significant decrease in the foot traffic into workforce centers. I don't think that's altogether due to the fact that people have given up. I think that's actually too pessimistic. I think we're actually having an impact, and people are starting to get jobs, and you're starting to see the unemployment rate going down and the employment rate going up fairly significantly in Minnesota in most areas. And then you'd also expect to see a dramatic increase in economic assistance utilization, and that has been true. But in food support, that's primarily due to a policy change. We don't count asset limits in food support anymore based on a federal policy change. And because of that, and because of outreach efforts, more and more people have gotten onto food support. But in other economic assistance programs, of course, people have been in dire straits during this recession, and they have appropriately used economic assistance programs. However, we're starting to see those levels begin to level out. So what I really wanted to draw your attention to is, first of all, we probably don't deserve about two-thirds of the credit because that's really based on sociodemographics and that change. But about a third, I think we do, of what's going on. And that's based on good management, good policy, which is set by you, and using that policy along with things like technology to change what we do. And as a result, I think you're starting to see a real impact on the bottom line, increased revenue in some areas because of good policy, but also fairly dramatic decreases in expenditures based on the macro trends that I just outlined for you.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. That was very informative. Something I'd like to have a sociologist help explain, just the opposite of what you think. When you have a bad recession and people are struggling, how those changes, like in child protection, the divorce rate's down, the crime rate is quite dramatically down, and you would almost expect just the opposite. There's a lot of good trends we're seeing in Minnesota right now. Traffic fatalities are way down, which may mean there's a lot less people driving drunk on our roads, because that was a major driver of that oftentimes. And so it's really interesting that when times are tough, people must just buckle down and behave. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know if a sociologist could explain it. It's good news for us, because you'd expect just the opposite. Right. But let's hope it continues as the economy ticks back up. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that what you're describing as the sociodemographic change? Could you embellish on the meaning of that?
Yes.
Now, you mentioned that investing early on in some prevention things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could see that driving it, but so you could take some credit for that. But what? Tell me a little more about what those changes are.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, what I mean by that is, in the way I've oversimplified it probably, is I say better communities, better families, better parents, better kids, compared to the mid to 60s to middle 70s, and no offense to anyone who might belong to those eras, it's simply statistical. And so let's say during those eras there is about a 10% what is called a deviance rate. People who are willing to act out with drugs, alcohol, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That was about right. But the normal deviance rate within society is about 5%. So it was about 10% during that time frame, and it's about 5% and actually decreasing in the last two generations. And so we've simply gotten better. We've gotten better as a society. We've gotten better as communities. We've gotten better as families. We've gotten better as parents. And we're seeing better results with our children as a result. And so the deviance rate in all those areas like drug use and even teen pregnancy and so on, all of those have been fairly going down fairly significant. Senator, does that make sense? Okay.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you maybe dissect or get into what you said about you seem to, like at the workforce centers, the population is going down. I've had feedback from different individuals across the state where, you know, I do think that there is a population out there that has given up, mm-hmm. and it seems like it's not the younger population. It's kind of those that are on the high middle to senior kind of age men and women that have been searching for work for a long time but haven't been able to get hired. Some of it could be due to the mismatch of training, but I think a lot of it might even be due to discrimination against those who are in that age group.
Mr. Walsh?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Stump, you're exactly correct that this recession has disproportionately impacted certain groups. And those groups are people of color, men, youth, and older workers. That has been the this disparity in this recession. If you're high school educated or below, if you are white, female, professional, educated, then the unemployment rate for you stayed. It went up, but it went up actually rather insignificant. So the recession impacted those other groups much more dramatic, and so those folks are, if you look at who has given up, you know, that, so we go from, let's say, you know, 7-8% in Minnesota, all the way up to 15% if you count those who are underemployed or have given up. If you look at that 8%, a lot of those folks are the folks you're describing.
Madam Chair, do you have suggestions as to how those people or what services those people could either take advantage of or how we might be able to adjust the services so that we might be able to help them reenter in the workforce?
Mr. Walsh?
Madam Chair and Senator Stump, I belong to the Dakota Scott Workforce Investment Board, and we're studying that very thing. And one of the things that we focused in on is we've been studying failure for a long time. And what I mean by that is we go and we try to find why is it, what's wrong with the group that is disproportionately impacted by recessions, what's wrong with them? That's what we tend to study. And instead, the Dakota Scott Workforce Investment Board is saying no. If you find a group of, let's say, African-Americans who are doing really well in Atlanta, let's study their success. Let's study the success of why it is in that group with why they're doing very well. And let's do the same thing with of course, American Indians are also disproportionately impacted and so on. Let's study their success, where they are successful, and then let's take those studies about success and then let's apply them to our workforce center activities.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, having a sociologist come and talk to us about all this would be really interesting. You know, there are studies that have been done that show that if people can't afford to get divorced, they don't get divorced. But then what happens is the domestic abuse rate goes up, and then we find more people in emergency rooms, and on it goes. And Now, if you aren't working, you aren't driving to work, so you're not getting into an accident on slick roads or bad weather or whatever. So it would be really interesting to just kind of see the 2, 3, and 4 outs on just the issue of you know, losing your job and the recession and all of that. I'd encourage you to find somebody to come and talk to us.
It is interesting because it doesn't seem to follow what you'd expect the trends to be, but it's encouraging. It's encouraging, mm-hmm. And maybe when people face adversity, they just channel their energies differently and behave better. It seems they're behaving better.
Or maybe everybody's just sitting on Facebook and Twitter all the time. They're not going anywhere.
Could be, Mr. Walsh.
Madam Chair, I didn't mean to put a smiley face on the Great Recession. That really, you know, but and my background is in public policy. I'm this close to getting my doctorate from Hamline University in public administration, and I'm also a psychologist, so I really look at it from those perspectives. But a sociologist could look at trends much better than I could. But those are the sociodemographic trends. And it is interesting that what does happen when people are unemployed and what are the economic pressures, and then as a result of those economic pressures, how do people behave? But there are also some positive trends as a result of us banding together during the recession. There was some good stuff, too. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Walsh. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Gustafson, for a very thorough presentation. And members, on Thursday, we're going to have our hearing for confirmation for our MMB Commissioner, Jim Showalter. Good. And we'll be starting that at 8:30, so we hope you can join us. And if you have some questions for him, you might want to think about that for a little bit. And for those of you who missed, I do have a new CA that I'm sharing with Senator Magnus. It's Jennifer Burquam. And she's in room 206. So if you have a bill or something that you want heard in this committee, she will be our point of contact. And, of course, my LA, John Lundberg, is also still here and willing to help out any committee members or members of the Senate. Okay? So with that, the meeting is adjourned.